Hi, everyone. This is Chad. As I mentioned last week on the podcast, this was supposed to be our 100th episode. It was supposed to come out before the last podcast, but because I didn't have my computer for a week, we had to delay releasing it, so it's coming out a little bit late. Basically, what that means is that some of the dates and some of the immediacy of the headlines that we're talking about are going to be a week out of date, but I think the topics and the themes that we're talking about are still really relevant. So we're going to go ahead and release this podcast to you anyway. And our new podcast featuring a new sports story and the third episode of Rings of Power will be coming out to you on Monday. So in the meantime, enjoy some bonus crunching tackles. Welcome to Crunching Tackles, where we break down the hardest-hitting social issues in sports. On today's show, sports are about watching great people achieve great things, but they're also a reality TV show focused on entertaining us, the consumer. Who are the athletes that best cross over this athlete-to-entertainer philosophy, and what makes them a success? My name is Chad Wiley, and with me, as always, is John Nekrasov. And John, this is our 100th episode of Crunching Tackles podcast, which is kind of crazy that we've done this.
Number 100 all the way through. It's been like 2.5 years, something like that.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, thank you to everyone who is listening at this, in this day and age, in the year 2022. We've got, I don't know. I was just kind of thinking about like what would be a fun episode to, you know, go over for 100. And I don't know. I've been thinking a lot about the kind of like athletes, like you mentioned, that, I don't know, just keep us focused on the technique of the game and not just like winning trophies. So we'll get into that later, but I don't know, that's been rolling around in my mind a lot.
Yeah, we're going to get into that after a little bit of current events. We don't have a pop culture segment this week. John, I feel like we've really only talked about two sports stories for like the last month and a half, and it's because there really are the only two sports stories going on.
Yeah.
And honestly, we could also talk about the Brittany Griner story more, because there's more there too, but it's a very minor thing. It's just the fact that Dennis Rodman said he was going to go to Russia to negotiate on her behalf.
I feel like that's a movie waiting to happen.
Really funny after him like going to North Korea. He's just
I forgot
a weird,
about that.
Yeah, he's just a weird
that's
guy, right?
Right?
So that's not a real story, but we've been talking a lot about Deshaun Watson. We've been talking a lot about Liv, and we're going to do more of that this today. This Deshaun Watson thing, I think when we last left it, the ruling by Judge Sue L. Robinson had come down, and then we didn't know at that point that the NFL was appealing. Is that correct?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. And then we kind of didn't talk about it for a while, and so what's happened in the meantime is that Roger Goodell announced that another former federal judge, would be reviewing the appeal, and the ruling would then come, and it did, and it was increased to 11 games suspended with a $5 million fine. This was actually not a ruling, though. This was something that was settled before the ruling came down. This was a mutually agreed upon settlement by the NFL and representatives for Deshaun Watson. John, there's kind of like, I have one angle from this that I am really interested in talking about, but if you have any like general comments on this punishment, if you deem it sufficient, more sufficient, if you just have any general thoughts, I'd love to hear, because I think this left a lot of people still kind of underwhelmed by the at least the game element of this punishment.
Yeah, I'll say I'm still not happy with this. You know, Goodell in numerous statements about the sentencing, if you will, that was being handed down to Deshaun, basically said, you know, the evidence against him is pretty overwhelming that he has committed heinous and predatory, like Goodell used the word predatory to describe Deshaun, and said what he did was emphatically wrong. And, you know, as a result, NFL decided to appeal the initial decision and has reached this settlement with Deshaun and the NFLPA. And I again, you know, as we've discussed, the power here to ultimately decide on the appeal and this, you know, whatever suspension that Deshaun is going to get lies largely in Goodell's hands. And Goodell, in his statement, said Deshaun is committed to doing the hard work on himself that is necessary for his return to the NFL. And I think, you know, we've talked a lot about whether Deshaun even deserves to earn his right back to return to the NFL. And I just don't, 11 games isn't even a full season. You know, it's almost double the initial suspension that he was going to serve. But I don't know, I just find myself, when we're all openly admitting, you know, he settled with 23 out of 24 of these women, he's now settled with the NFL, though he hasn't outright like admitted guilt, the NFL is acting as if he's guilty. And for the NFL to act as if he's guilty and then not even give him a full year, settle for less than that, settle for a pretty small fine compared to his like $230 million odd salary, I'm glad it's more than it was, but it's still, for me, like, I don't think he should play again. I said it before, I said it again, you know, I will say it again. You know, it I don't think it's doing justice to any of the women that, you know, he preyed upon throughout his time with the Texans. And I don't think it's doing justice to any of the women that who are going to have to deal with him for the rest of his NFL career. You know, I just think it's settling for something still that small, I think, is the wrong call. And quote by Cleveland Browns co-owner Jimmy Haslam, he said, is he never supposed to play again? Is he never supposed to be part of society? I think it's important to remember that Deshaun is 26 years old, okay, and is a valuable NFL quarterback, and we're planning on him being our quarterback for a long time. And just like the fact that people are looking these allegations dead in the face, basically admitting that they're true in terms of actions, not like outright, but in terms of how they're dealing with the situation, and then basically largely letting it slide, to me, just, I don't know, it just makes me sick.
There might be a large section of fans who hear you say something like that and say, oh, well, you, like, oh, John doesn't believe in second chances. And that's, like, not the case, and it's not the case for me either.
Not at all.
But I think that, like, a huge part of a second chance is, like, remorse. That's true, like, in religion, that's true in society, that's just true in life, that, like, part of the road to coming back to your job, to a family, if the family problems, that starts with genuine contrition and remorse, which to date we still have not really seen.
Not Deshaun, even a little bit.
He said something like he said that he apologized to anyone who was triggered or something like that is what he said again, which is just a completely incomplete and inappropriate half apology for what is being alleged against him. I think you mentioned the idea of like 11 games, which being light, and that's true. Obviously, like, again, we did all the comparisons, but that's still less than what Calvin Ridley got for betting on NFL games. But I think that the other thing about the 11 games that particularly surprises me is when you think about this being a settlement, and I guess whenever something is settled, you wonder what the reasoning for the two parties was to settle. And I think that for the league, it probably had something to do with just kind of wanting this over with. You know, this was generating a lot of really bad headlines for the Browns, for the league, for everyone involved, and they probably just wanted it over with. My guess is that the reasoning for the Brown or for the Watson camp to settle is because they thought that this could be a lot worse, right? Like, there's no incentive for them to settle if they thought that the 6-game suspension was going to be upheld. It doesn't really seem to be any worse for them to have the story continue to be in the headlines, unless Deshaun Watson just really didn't want to answer any more questions about it, but he's avoided the media anyway. So I think that the reasoning for the Watson camp to agree to the settlement was because they knew that this could be a whole lot worse if this judge was allowed to render a ruling. My big point about this, though, and this is, I'm a little confused on it, but Roger Goodell has the power, still under the new collective bargaining agreement, still has the ultimate punishing power.
Right.
And it was Roger Goodell who chose to delegate this appeal to another person, to this judge who was going to read all the evidence and issue the appellate ruling. After delegating it, Roger Goodell came out and said that he believed Deshaun Watson should be suspended for a season.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't understand, if he has an opinion on it and he's the ultimate authority, why he wouldn't just do that if he had the power to. If he believes that Deshaun Watson should be suspended for a season, then he should suspend Deshaun Watson for a season. And I'm trying to figure out why he wouldn't do that, and I'm thinking that maybe it would have to do with worrying about a lawsuit from the Watson camp or from the Players Association or something about the imaging of him making this ruling, or maybe this judge is viewed as more neutral and so it might go over a little bit better. But again, the power rests with him. That's part of his job description. That's why he's getting $50 million and a jet every year from the NFL, is so that he can do these kind of things. And so for him to say, I have an opinion and here's what it is, then he should just take the responsibility and give the suspension that he thinks is deserved. And it makes no sense to me why he delegated it to a judge who was then obviously didn't even issue a ruling because it was settled. But that part was really, really weird to me.
Yeah, I mean, we did a whole episode on commissioners, right? Talking a lot about Goodell and the way he handles situations like this. And, you know, I don't know the nitty-gritty of what's going on behind the scenes with him either, but it does strike me that if he has the actual authority, that him not acting is sort of an attempt to make sure that he's not too culpable for anything that happens, right? Which is, you know, kind of the name of the game for both the commissioner and for the league, is just, you know, making sure that there's enough degrees of removal from any serious decisions you make that could have public blowback. And I think that's frustrating because you'd like to see Goodell actually have some backbone for once. And it seems like he's willing to take a clear stance, at least in what he's saying, but to not back that up with actions, I think you're right, is odd. And I wonder what's happening with that.
Right. Like, yeah, if he doesn't want to give the ruling, then why is he giving an opinion?
Because right, exactly.
If he has the power to make the decision and he has an opinion, then I don't understand why he wouldn't then just make the decision. If he believes a year is right, then suspend him for a year. He has every mm-hmm. single legal right under the collectively bargained agreement to do so. And I guess the PlayStation could try to sue under some, you know, I don't even know what the suit would be, because it's collectively bargained, like they agreed to it. So I don't even know what the lawsuit there would be. I'm sure part of it has to do with that, the fact that Jimmy Haslam is one of Roger Goodell's 32 bosses. Mm-hmm. And that's obviously, you know, we talked about that in the commissioner episode, is that when you work for the owners and Jimmy Haslam is one of those owners, that obviously is going to complicate things.
Right.
And we mentioned in that example that the one commissioner with a lot of backbone was Adam Silver. In forcing one of his bosses to quit, you know, to sell his team was a huge tone setter for his job as NBA commissioner. And we haven't seen that from Goodell. And we have a whole podcast if you want to hear more about that. I agree with you that I don't think that I think to say that he should never play again sounds right to me, or at least indefinite until remorse.
Mm-hmm.
I think that being sorry for what you do when it's something this severe should be a prerequisite, and taking mm-hmm. genuine steps to make it right should be a prerequisite toward coming back into this league, because it's going to be really weird seeing him, you know, if the Browns make the playoffs, you know, if they're around 500 with those six games left at the end of the season and they make the playoffs, mm-hmm. that's going to be really, really weird watching Deshaun Watson in the playoffs this year.
I really enjoyed Jacoby Brissett when asked, how is it going to feel having to, you know, have Deshaun Watson, you know, kind of waiting in the wings for you? Like, will you feel like you need to be playing like him to you know, keep your spot? And Jacoby looks at the reporter and says, backup quarterback for the Browns, he says, oh, trust me, it'll be very easy not to be Deshaun Watson this year. And I was like, you know what? You're right.
You're right.
I appreciated that. I appreciated the candor. You know, it felt like a very obvious dig at Deshaun, and, you know, maybe a little bit at the Browns organization too for bringing him on. We talked about this a little bit, but I'd be interested to see kind of what the situation is like in that locker room with mm-hmm. him there. You know, I don't know the opinions of everyone there, but I'd like to hope that maybe he's a, you know, a little bit of a disgraced figure in that locker room. You'd hope.
Yeah, you would hope so. John, I guess we'll move along. I guess we can kind of put the closing pin on this story. It's over.
Yeah.
This story is now shut. The Liv story, however, John,
lives on.
Liv lives. And this is kind of exactly, this kind of brings everything full circle about what Phil Mickelson and those infamous comments originally said Liv was all about. And it was to use Liv as a bargaining chip to get the PGA Tour to change. And that's finally happening. And Phil Mickelson might not be able to benefit from it because he's already been suspended by the PGA. But the PGA has taken some really, really massive steps this week. And it all started with Tiger Woods flying to the second round of the playoffs, the last week's tournament, to meet with top players to discuss how the PGA Tour can move going forward. And Tiger Woods has been the face of golf for since he was 3 years old. But no, for a long time. I mean, for a long, long time. And alongside who I believe is the current face of golf, which is Rory McIlroy, they have come up with some really, really awesome stuff for the PGA Tour. One of those things is an additional increase of $150 million going to players each season. And part of that is going to come in the form of elevated events. And this is a really awesome idea. And what elevated events basically means is it's saying that the top 20 players, according to the Player Impact Program, which is an analytics thing that measures players, PGA Tour players, you know, popularity as well as their wins. So like their, it's kind of a combination of PR and popularity with actual excellence on the course, and from that comes a ranking system. And there's end of year bonuses related to your PIP score. If you're first place, that's an extra $15 million at the end of the year. And what they're doing is they're saying that the top 20 people in PIP have to play the same 13 events, not including the majors. And what this basically does is, if you watch PGA Tour on a week to week, you kind of don't always know who's going to be there. Like, it's kind of like, oh, well, like maybe Tony Finau will show up for this event, or oh, maybe Rory McIlroy will show up for this event. But you never really get the strongest fields with everyone in them outside of the majors, the Players' Championship, and then like one or two other events, like the Genesis or the Memorial. And what this is doing is it's actually making 13 of those events where you're going to get the best players every year.
Interesting.
To come to these events. And so these top 20 people, they actually are going to be obligated to play 20 tournaments. So to get your bonus at the end of the year, you have to play these 13 elevated events plus the four majors, so that's 17, plus three other PGA Tour events. So that's 20 events a year, and 13 of them will be strong field events. So all the top 20 players playing in the same 13 events, like I said. And I think this is going to be really, really good because it's going to kind of elevate other events to the status of mini majors or like mini players championships, where you're going to see week to week the best golfers playing the best golfers instead of, you know, Rory McIlroy won the RBC with like a very, very soft field, or Tony Finau won two tournaments in a row and he didn't, you know, you don't really recognize any other names on that leaderboard. This is going to kind of bring a playoff atmosphere on a weekly basis throughout the PGA Tour season.
That's fascinating, genuinely. I know we've talked about, I guess, kind of the potential positives, like thinking about, you know, does Phil have a point? I think is a question we've asked on here. I don't know. I guess my question for you with all that, as the golf guy, as someone who does watch golf pretty regularly week in and week out, do you think that this will end up being a situation where LIV actually, even if LIV doesn't survive, if LIV actually makes the game of golf better as a product for the PGA? Because, you know, I think about like how both the NBA and the NFL have had to kind of ward off rival leagues at various points in their history. It wasn't just like they were the automatic, you know, America's league, right? Like there have been various points where America's biggest sports leagues have kind of had to establish their brands as the preeminent sports brand. You know, PGA, if the PGA actually manages to ward off LIV and LIV eventually dies, do you think in the long run this is actually something that golf needed potentially?
Yeah, I think that this makes the PGA Tour better. I don't know if LIV was required to make this happen, I guess. Would there have been a way to collectively like threaten a boycott or do something else in order to put the same pressure on the PGA Tour as these players leaving for another tour? Ultimately, I think that it's hard to say that you know, this validates Phil, because the reality is he ended up not using Liv as a bargaining chip. He just left. And right. So even when these things are being implemented, that doesn't impact Phil, who has signed a multi-year deal with Liv, or these other guys who have signed multi-year big signing bonus deals. But is the PGA Tour better today than it was a week ago? Yeah, it is. And Liv is obviously part of that. But, you know, Tiger and Rory, their part in this was actually to kind of like stop Liv. It was kind of, you know, they weren't coming at it from, oh, let's use Liv as a bargaining chip. It's like, how can we stop this bleeding of players going to Liv? And it makes me wonder if these players had that power all along. Like, if Tiger and Rory had come to the PGA Tour before this and said, hey, this is what we need to do, would that have worked? I don't know. I guess you can never really know in a hypothetical like that. It's weird to say that like Liv somehow did what it was supposed to do, because Liv still feels very slimy and wrong, mm-hmm. and I still wish it had never happened. But for the people who will still be part of the PGA Tour, it's great. I think it's super interesting that this week for the Tour Championship, Rory is paired with Cameron Smith for the first day, who is one of the kind of the biggest names still thinking about going to Liv, and so what impact would he have on Cam? The other part of this announcement, announced in a really, really awesome hype video tweeted by Tiger Woods, is this thing that I still don't know a lot of details about, but it's going to be a Monday night primetime indoor golf extravaganza connected to the PGA Tour. It's going to be a team event, six teams of three. It's going to be all the top golfers. It's like part virtual, like hitting into a net with like a screen. And then there's going to be some real elements as well, like a real putting green, real sand bunkers, real things like that. And they, you know, it was just announced yesterday. It's still very conceptual. It's a fusion of golf and technology and entertainment and fan experience in an indoor setting that's going to be on Monday nights throughout the PGA Tour season, starting in January 2024. Again, don't know a lot about it, but I'm super intrigued by the idea. I think particularly having it in a primetime spot is awesome, because, you know, golf is kind of happening at the worst possible time.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's happening during your weekday on Thursday and Friday when you're at work, and then Saturday is your chores day, and then Sunday if you go to church and then you have a lunch, and then you kind of catch the last hour or something on a Sunday. And so to have something Monday night in primetime, like, I think that's going to be really big for the PGA Tour's exposure. And depending on how this goes, from the way it's being talked about, this sounds like it could be something that's really, really cool as well.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, on the face of it, you know, I'm obviously not, as we've discussed numerous times, I don't really know very much about, I will say I know more about golf after this summer than I've ever known in my life. We'll just say that. But that being said, you know, an indoor kind of like hype golf setting like that, you know, maybe I would go with you sometime in 2024, 2025. That sounds intriguing. I'm not going to lie. Like, you know, would I shell out the money to go to the Masters? Probably not. But, you know, would I go for a night to, you know, the Kane Stadium and watch? Because Tiger Woods will be participating
in this event,
which I'm sure is thrilling for you. But because he doesn't have to walk around anywhere. So
right.
It's kind of
situation. It's perfect for a guy like him. Literally, it's perfect.
Which is what
McElroy
said. It's
really fun. Yeah. John, that's kind of all I have. Well, you know, these changes will happen over the next couple years. We'll see if there's any more defections. So this story will kind of continue a little bit going forward.
Yeah, I think my final point on the circumstances, maybe not necessarily that Liv was needed, but I think the monopoly questions have been interesting, you know, and that in what the Liv golfers have been trying to push, which is that the PGA is just trying to monopolize golf in America. You know, I think it makes sense to have kind of our leagues kind of enshrined legally to kind of keep things organized and at this point where they are. But I will say that there's kind of like, it may not be that we want Liv to exist, but it is forcing the PGA to evolve from a market perspective. You know, I don't think this would have happened easily, and I don't think McIlroy and Woods would have pushed for this as hard as they seem to have been doing if it were not for Liv. So I think that's kind of where my mind's at with this, just to clarify that from earlier.
Yeah, it takes something to change the status quo, mm-hmm. like you said. And we, yeah. is it is that or does that mean we're going to look very fondly on Liv?
No, absolutely not. No, we still don't like Liv.
But it's an interesting chapter in the story.
Yeah.
Especially if Liv doesn't continue very long. And oh, it'd be so great if like the Saudi Arabia just lost all their money. That'd be so wonderful. But regardless of that, this is the outcome that Phil was talking about in those first mm-hmm. comments, and that's the outcome that's now happening.
Yep. So yes,
John, let's get to the big story this week. I don't think we need to take a break. We can just power on.
Let's power on.
What's going on with your brain cells? And you got this bit of inspiration for our 100th episode.
Yeah. So I don't know. I've been thinking a lot about, like I mentioned at the top of the hour, about, you know, the kinds of athletes that inspire us to view sports almost as like fun, you know, to put it like really simply and bluntly. You know, when you think about the greatest athletes in the history of sports, you know, often players like Tom Brady come to mind, right? Just serial winners, people who, you know, hone their bodies and just beat themselves into the ground game after game, just stop at nothing basically to win at all costs. You know, people like Michael Jordan, who just winning is everything. You know, you lose one game and you hate everything about yourself. You hate all your teammates and yell at them for hours like Michael
Jordan
does.
Bill Belichick, Nick Saban, yeah. Mike Krzyzewski. You
know, these people who winning for them is everything in the sport. There's like a whole school of philosophy, even like in the soccer world, as soccer was developing as an organized sport, you kind of had this whole school of philosophy that was basically like, we will basically make this game as boring as possible to make sure that we don't make any mistakes and win every single game, regardless of how drab it is, regardless of whether we win every game 1-0 or not, you know? And players like Tom Brady, you know, Tom Brady has like flashy skills every so often, but most of the time, you know, he is a player who makes the right decisions, looks for the right passes, bides his time, and then does what he needs to do to win, no matter the time of the game, no matter the cost. And that's the kind of player I think that you need to be, that kind of serial winner, basically, the kind of person who can win 7 Super Bowls and just basically never stop, the kind of coach who will, like Pep Guardiola at Manchester City, will just drive his team to excellence year after year after year after year after year. But I've been thinking a lot about the kind of player who is a great in their sport, but in a different way. Because you have this kind of this other category of players that stick in the popular imagination. Like when you think about who your favorite athletes are, you've got the Michael Jordans, the people who are like the best of the best. And then you've got kind of like the players like Ronaldinho, who, you know, were really, really, really good, but did not necessarily always win as many trophies as the Tom Brady's and Michael Jordan's and Lionel Messi's of the world. But they still like stick in everyone's minds. They still stick in your mind as these people who just like took your breath away. And it wasn't because they were winning necessarily, but because they were doing things in their sport that you had never seen before. It was like a kind of like sports magic almost. I don't know. And I've been thinking a lot about who those people are and how they rise to kind of to the forefront, I guess, in our minds. And I don't know. I kind of wanted to talk through some of my favorite and your favorite athletes that do that and kind of think through, you know, what makes those people unique. And as sports continues to change, I guess, kind of think about where their place is in like an increasingly data-driven sports world, I guess, is kind of where my mind's at.
So when I was thinking through this topic and trying to come up with my personal list, I was not struggling, but having trouble wrapping my mind wholly around, like, what's the criteria for entertaining, right? Is it like social media following? Is it literally just my personal eye test? Like, when it's thinking about what are the factors that go into this category, like what makes someone objectively entertaining? Is it kind of, like I said, is it just like, oh, that looks great? Or is there some sort of like cultural impact that they have that's somehow quantifiable? Or how did you go about the process of like selecting these people? If it was just from like the John Nekrasov Hall of Fame, or was there some like objective part to it as well?
Yeah. For me, like, when I think about a player like Ronaldinho, was kind of like the top of my list of athletes who basically like personify that kind of like sports magic. And I think a lot of it comes down to, you know, Ronaldinho, if you didn't get to watch him, played in like, I think, the late 90s, early 2000s for Brazil and Barcelona a lot of his career. And he was just a magical player. He could do things with the ball. Like, I was watching some highlights before we started. He could do things with the ball, you know, and sit people down, you know, as he would come up with the ball on them. He could do things that you could never imagine anyone doing, that you'd never seen people do before. And it would take your breath away, but it wouldn't necessarily be the most efficient way of doing things. You know, in the modern era, soccer is all about passing the ball as fast as possible. You know, if you do too many unnecessary skills in a Pep Guardiola Manchester City team, you know, Pep is going to yell at you for doing too many unnecessary skills. But someone like Ronaldinho thrives in just being given that creativity, I guess, to wow the crowd. You know, someone like Pep doesn't want you to wow the crowd. Someone like Pep wants you to win, to do everything in the name of efficiency, I guess. And I guess, I don't know, my first criteria, I guess, would be that you're doing things just as much to wow the crowd and to have fun with, like, the game as it is to actually win the game, if that makes sense.
No, I think it makes perfect sense. I liked the word that you used, which was, like, unnecessary things.
Mm-hmm.
I think part of the entertainment is like someone who, you know, in whatever sport, does something that goes like above and beyond what they're taught to do. Like
right.
There is a technique that goes into winning, but then you can like do something extra cool with that technique. And there are specific examples of that. I also think that there's like a off the court, off the field component to this.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of gets into like the drama of reality TV. Someone who's always up for a jab at another player, someone who, you know, has interesting relationships with the media, someone who's very candid. Entertainment can come, you know, in front of a microphone. It can come on social media. There are other off the field components as well that go into entertainment. I think it's kind of a fusion of those things, is personality that's reflected in what you're doing in your sport, and then personality that's reflected in your interactions with others outside of it. Those are kind of the two things that I was thinking about. So do you have more on Ronaldinho as your number one? Or
yeah, I think for me, Ronaldinho and then your man Zlatan are two of the people mm-hmm. that best exemplify this. And I think Zlatan, I think, perfectly encapsulates the on-field, off-field dynamic that you're talking about.
Yeah.
Because there's almost nobody who says as outrageous things as Zlatan does at every possible opportunity and then backs them up with outrageous things on the field.
Right.
In a way, and they're good goals. He scores goals that, like, are objectively helpful, you know? Like, scoring a goal is good, right? But he scores goals in ridiculous ways. You know, like the infamous bicycle kick against England. Like, who thinks of doing that, right? Who sees
right.
the goalie out of his line and says, you know what, I'm going to do a bicycle kick from 40 yards out just because I can.
Yeah, like, that's the idea. Like, it's the kind of thing that, like, your regular player who's, like, just, if you're doing what you're drilled to do, you mm-hmm. would never even consider.
No.
Look up, if you don't know what I'm talking about, look up Zlatan Ibrahimovic goal versus England. And it is just something that no human being should ever try.
No.
And he's made a career of this. He's made a career of just doing absolutely outrageous things that work. And then, like you mentioned, and I've talked about Zlatan off the field a lot on this mm-hmm. podcast and in my life, from like funny confrontations to the things that he calls himself, to how candid he is in his books, to taking out newspaper ads in the Los Angeles Times saying you're welcome to the city of Los Angeles because he came to Los Angeles. He just goes above and beyond to be entertaining. I think it, you know, some people think that it comes across really conceited. I think it's just is like really funny. I think he's a genuinely humorous person. And I think that that's a big part of his appeal for me. Is not just that you watch him and you're like, oh, I have no idea what he's actually going to do today. He might do something I've never seen before. Mm-hmm. But it's also Like, I just want to, like, follow him on social media because he's just a funny person.
Yeah, no, I think a huge part, kind of going back to those two initial criteria you talked about, is I think these entertainers do everything they do because they are trying to entertain people. And it's like very much a personality thing. Like those on-field things don't really happen without the off-field personality, I think, is something that's important to note. You know, Zlatan doesn't even try those things, like you said, unless he has the persona that says, you know what, maybe I should try this just because I can. You know, it shapes the way you perform on the field. And, you know, you think of someone like Ronaldinho, who the most crazy recent story that, you know, went pretty viral, I guess it was a couple years ago. You know, this is a World Cup winner, a Champions League winner, someone who won millions and millions of dollars throughout his career, was arrested and put in jail, I believe in Peru, for trying to enter the country on a, like, forged passport. Mm-hmm. And was, like, winning soccer tournaments in his prison. Mm-hmm. While being, like, you know, this is, like, one of the most recognizable people of all time, trying to sneak into a country. Passport guy looks at him and is like, aren't you Ronaldinho? And, you know, he's like, oh, what do you mean I'm Ronaldinho? Of course not. You know, they're right. Like, yeah, you are.
Right.
But, like, a normal person doesn't ever think of trying that, right? Like, a normal professional athlete would never even conceive of trying to, like, forge his way into a country. So, I don't know. I think it's just illustrations of what we're talking about.
Yeah. Bring it to America a little bit, and we'll start with football. You mentioned Odell Beckham Jr. here on our notes, and this is an interesting case because Odell Beckham Jr. is viewed as an entertainer because he did one thing that was really cool. Yeah. Like, he did this one thing that was outrageous and he should not have tried to do, and it worked, and then everyone kind of put this thing over him, and it's interesting to think about whether or not he's actually lived up to what this one moment. If you don't know what I'm talking about, it's the Thanksgiving Day catch against the Cowboys when he catches mm-hmm. a football with, like, 2.5 fingers. And, you know, so, like, if you go to schools, everyone's trying to catch the ball one-handed and saying, Odell, while they do it. That's what he did. And he's a good wide receiver. He's a good route runner. He's fast. He has good hands. But he's never had another moment quite like that. But he is viewed in a tier kind of above your average football player because of this kind of reputation that goes before right. him. Yeah.
I think that's an interesting point. I was honestly struggling thinking about the NFL to even, like, think of players who kind of, like, showboat in the NFL.
There's one.
There is one, which we're going to talk about. Yeah. We're going to talk about him. But I was struggling to think of other ones because, I don't know, I guess football, in a way that other sports don't, really doesn't lend itself well to showboating. The nature of it, of how fast it is, of how kind of how everything's driven by, like, very set plays. You know, there's actually not a lot of room for individual creativity aside from the quarterback. So I don't know. I do think you're right. That makes sense regarding OBJ. But that was something that like stuck out to me a lot. You know, like, a lot of your creativity with an NFL player is going to come from off field stuff.
And even a lot then, of off-field stuff.
Yeah. Even then, a lot of them aren't super outspoken, it feels like.
Off-field is where you get stuff like Marshawn Lynch, who's viewed as really funny in interviews and does commercials.
He's an icon. Yeah.
You get Peyton Manning in commercials. Rob Gronkowski is someone who's really funny WWE yeah. stuff. Like, I think I kind of want to end on the athletes who literally cross over into entertainment. And mm-hmm. Rob Gronkowski is an example of that. That's kind of where I want to wrap this up. But in terms of on the field, John, I think we're in one mind here that Patrick Mahomes is the one
right.
who dares to dream mm-hmm. on the field. I saw him the other day practicing a behind the back spiral pass that's going off. He's nailing it off the crossbar of the field goal post. Mm-hmm. He's like spinning it behind his back. This is a guy who throws footballs with both hands, throws them while parallel to the ground, as we've talked about in playoff games. Mm-hmm. There's nothing that he doesn't think he can do when he's on a football field.
And he's largely right, which is the crazy part, right? The skill difference you know, we've gone back and forth many times about how many Super Bowls Mahomes is going to win, and you know where his I think actually his decisions to use his skill in various ways, I think, is actually a perfect example in the modern world of kind of the dilemma of the performer, because Mahomes has the skill to pull off almost any pass anywhere on the field that he wants to, in a sport where a lot of the time you're just supposed to make the read and throw the pass, you know. Yeah. In that kind of situation, Mahomes decides to scramble with five players around him, and then, like, while parallel to the ground, throw a sidearm pass, you know,
with
like
his eyes closed.
With his eyes closed over everybody.
Yeah.
And just somehow make the pass anyway, right? Which is astonishing. I think he's an interesting case because we have seen at times over the last two seasons where some of those decisions have not come off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when he first got into the league, a lot of the times it was like, oh my goodness, everything he's touching is turning to gold. His team was incredible. They were catching the passes he was throwing. The last couple seasons, it's been, you know, you still see those flashes of brilliance, but at times you're like, okay, just make the simple pass, right? Just throw the ball, throw it away, mm-hmm. hand it off. You know, you don't need to get flashy every time. And I think in the modern world where sports analytics are increasingly kind of becoming the sort of the weapon of every team and also like every knowledgeable fan, right? Who, you know, breaks down every game for like hours after they watch it and says, you know, oh, well, the quarterback could have done this and this and this and this and this differently. You know, when you're watching a player trying to entertain you and then make kind of a simple decision overcomplicated by, you know, basically kind of trying to have fun, then it's much easier, I think, now than it was, you know, like say back in the 60s or 70s when a soccer player, you know, who fans don't have tape to watch, you know, a soccer player just suddenly takes on eight players by himself because he can. You know, there's a big difference in the world between that and then fans overanalyzing you on Twitter for, you know, like the next 3 weeks after the Super Bowl saying, yeah. Okay, you made all these decisions wrong because you had too much trust in your abilities, basically. So I think Mahomes is honestly a great example of this, of someone who has the skill basically to be the most fun player in the NFL and is the most fun player in the NFL. But like, we also see like sometimes the consequences of that, which I think is interesting.
Yeah, and a lot of that comes back to what you said about football being like the ultimate team sport, right? So mm-hmm. less individual control, you know, there's just so many other factors that go into football besides just what the quarterback can do. And when he gets schemed against, especially in Super Bowls or playoff games, you kind of see that kind of come to bear. John, I think kind of like my last really big example, we could talk about like the Showtime Lakers, who literally like their whole point was to be entertaining, and like the mm-hmm. players. I'm watching, this is the pop culture segment of the day. There's a Hulu documentary coming out right now called Legacy, the True Story of the LA Lakers. And it's kind of like the Lakers' response to Winning Time, the HBO series. It has all of the actual Lakers people interviewed, from, you know, Kareem and Magic to Jerry West to the Buss family to LeBron to Kobe before he passed. Everyone's in it. And in it, you know, Magic Johnson, they're talking about how they were so conscious that the style of basketball they play matched the energy of the entertainment that was happening in Los Angeles. And so they're kind of like the biggest example in the NBA of people, of players who had this symbiotic relationship with the fans and the celebrities and the dancing, and kind of fused it into their style of play. They're an interesting example. We could talk about baseball as well and their struggle with being entertaining. But I think one of the more polarizing examples that I want to talk about was Nick Kyrgios in tennis. Mm-hmm. Because he's kind of like the anti-Zlatan.
Right.
He's kind of like the guy who's trying to do the same thing as Zlatan does, and it usually doesn't come across as well. And he has problems in his personal life. He's got some ongoing legal issues in Australia that we're not going to have time to get into. But this is a guy who, again, does things on the tennis court that are not necessary, like hitting the ball between his legs, hitting underarm serves, just trying outrageous things. And this is also a guy who verbally abuses umpires, verbally abuses fans, verbally abuses opponents. He comes across as a loose cannon. And I don't think that he comes across nearly as charming as someone like Zlatan does. And I think he really struggles to also be taken seriously as an athlete, because he's kind of viewed as a clown. Even though I don't view him that way. I think he's a very serious player. He was in a Wimbledon final. Like, he's a very good player. But I think he has struggled to kind of be viewed seriously because he's so focused on the entertaining.
Yeah. I think part of it is that, like, if you're trying to be entertaining but you're also really abrasive, that creates a different impression than someone who's just trying to have fun, right? Because you have the athletes who, you know, I think of Mario Balotelli back in his, like, the heyday of his Italy days around, like, the early 2010s, back when he was at Manchester City, who he clearly enjoyed, you know, his tricks and whatever, and was a really talented player. He had a ton of crazy off-field problems. And he wasn't necessarily abrasive, but he was just a complete loose cannon, you know, that literally let fireworks off in his own house at one point. Like, set his entire house on fire. It was crazy.
Yeah.
You know, and so you end up in situations where you start making more and more, like, kind of erratic decisions, and it drives sometimes insane gameplay, but it also can create off-field situations that in the end sink your career, like it did for him. I think Kyrgios, like, players like Neymar in the modern era are very much like showboaters who are, in a lot of senses, when they're showboating, are trying to humiliate people. Mm-hmm. You know, Neymar has been tackled viciously numerous times in Liga for trying to rainbow players, you know, and showing them up.
Yeah.
But he's not necessarily like an abrasive off-field presence. And Kyrgios is very much that kind of like antagonizer. And I think when someone is trying to showboat in that way, it comes off as like a show off, and not just as someone who's trying to entertain the crowd. And I think that may be part of the difference. Is like, there's a difference between trying to dunk on someone and like humiliate them, and right, humiliating them while you're like kind of having fun. Like, I think a crowd can kind of like sense who they like in that sense and who is just a talented person that's just kind of a jerk.
Yeah, I get the sense that Kyrgios, is a lot of what he's doing is to get a reaction out of the fans. Mm-hmm. And he's certainly not the first person to do a tweener or to do an underarm serve. He just does them more often. But it's kind of just that inability to turn it off in between points. Like, I really don't mind his tweeners. Like, I don't think those are necessarily, those usually are for the fans. But it's like, it's just the shouting matches with fans, and sometimes that's kind of good natured. Like, he's had some pretty funny verbal interactions with fans that you can find on YouTube that are pretty funny, but particularly with refs, particularly with opponents, I don't think he's regarded highly at all by his peers, by people over him. And I think he's really struggled to break into the mainstream, because he really is as talented as any tennis player alive right now. He's really, really talented, but he has just struggled in a unique way that I think Mario Balotelli is a good example, where the questions are, is this guy like self-imploding when really all he's trying to do is be entertaining?
Yeah, I think you can kind of, your loose cannon personalities easily become those kinds of non-standard players. And I think it's hard when you have an athlete like that who, you know, wants to show off and wants to perform. There is definitely a fine line between being that entertaining character loved by the fans and becoming kind of an imploding almost villain to the fans if you go too far down kind of your own path and are perceived as like not a team player or not respecting the sport, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that that's a line that many of these like infamous players and famous players that we talk about kind of end up walking in various ways. When you think of someone like Diego Maradona, who is maybe we've both listened to a podcast called 22 Goals that starts off by talking about his infamous goal, I think in the 1986 World Cup against England, that he scored with his hand. You know, he was one of the most iconic players of all time and one of the most entertaining players of all time, but he simply never could shake this off-field drama that followed him everywhere, where he'd get in fights on the field, off the field. You know, he had drug problems. He know, obviously scored a goal with his hand and then basically bragged about it for years afterward and, you know, rubbing it in the English people's faces. And you end up, as a player like that, kind of always grappling with kind of the double-edged sword of being sort of that person who's playing to and for the fans rather than just for, you know, winning.
Yeah. John, as we kind of come to the end of our hour here, I'm wondering if you have any examples. We're talking about the crossover between sports and entertainment, and I'm wondering if you have any examples of people who have literally made that crossover, either entertainers who have tried sports, mm-hmm. like the Paul brothers, or athletes who have transitioned into being like legitimate entertainers. Thinking about Ronda Rousey and Ronda Rousey or Rob Gronkowski doing WWE, someone like Michael Strahan who transitioned into like regular journalism, athletes who might retire and do a podcast or do other things. I wonder if you have any examples of those kind of crossovers that you like or that have interested you.
I would like to hold forth our dear friend Shaquille O'Neal as perhaps the greatest example of this.
Okay.
Not actually the greatest example, but I mean, because you see a lot of athletes that, you know, move into acting or into music or all kinds of things. I personally love Shaq's presence across society, which is why I brought him up, because, you know, he's on TV obviously as an analyst, but he appears in random ads all the time and in goofy movies and stuff. And I don't know, I feel like Shaq is very much one of those kind of explosive, massive personalities that like both defined his sport back then and just like defines a whole swath of pop culture now. Like everyone knows who Shaq is.
Yeah.
And it's like a lot of it is obviously because of just the way he played and his hulking size. But, you know, I think his personality is a huge part of it too.
Yeah, I think my favorites are they're the athletes who try acting. which sometimes goes very badly, thinking about like Ronda Rousey in Furious 7 or LeBron James in Space Jam 2. But something like we just talked about like last week or 2 weeks ago, Hustle.
Mm-hmm.
That was awesome.
It was.
That was one of the best sports entertainment crossovers I've ever seen. And like, I think my all-time favorite is something like not the Uncle Drew movie, but the original Uncle Drew YouTube videos.
I don't think I've ever seen those. I've seen the movie.
The movie basically is a long version of these original YouTube videos where it started with just Kyrie, and then it was Kyrie and some other players would come in and they would just dominate these street basketball games as old people with these massive prosthetics. The original YouTube videos are so funny. Stuff like that I just love. I love because it just gives you a chance to see personality, to see humor, mm-hmm. to see the range that these athletes have as creative people. I've watched those. I've gone back to watch those Uncle Drew videos a lot over the last decade, and I just love them. Hustle was an awesome example. I love, and we talked about this with Hustle, but just seeing athletes out of where we normally see them. Mm-hmm. Having a chance to just be people and get to know their personalities just grows that affinity that we have. And that's kind of the point with all these people, is that it's when their personality shines forth, mm-hmm. not what they're drilled to do, not what their PR coaches teach them to say, but when true, genuine personality shines forth in the course of play, outside of the course of play, for good or for bad, that's when you get to see authentic, real people. And that's what, as people, we connect with.
I think that's what you see when athletes really take ownership of their social media. We get a real taste of that sometimes it was much harder for athletes to do back in the day. I think of someone like, you know, because a lot of athletes have like kind of PR managed Twitter accounts and they don't really actually say anything unique. But Alphonso Davies, the Canadian left back at Bayern, is a great example of someone who has his own thriving TikTok account and makes goofy videos all the time and is just very much, you know, there to like have fun, you know, as someone basically, I mean, younger than us, I think, just kind of enjoying social media just like we do and making goofy videos and engaging with his fans. I think there's, you know, we've talked a lot about how the changing generations in sports are being impacted by social media. And I think even as sports become, in a sense, more controlled by data and by analytics and by doing the right thing all the time. I think the kind of individual nature of Gen Z and future generations, I think, will kind of always clash with that to a degree.
Yeah, I think a lot of it, the generational thing. I think like the desire to see personality is also like a Gen Z thing too. Like the wanting to connect with athletes on a deeper level than just watching them play sports.
Right.
John, I don't want to start another 15-minute segment of this podcast, but are we really going to do an entire podcast about entertainment and never say the name Jose Mourinho? Are we even allowed to do this?
Or? See, but that's like a completely different kind of like entertainment though, because he's like a stand-up comic of rage.
It's drama.
Creates drama for the sake of drama.
It's like reality. It's literally like dating reality TV shows. It's what Absolutely. Jose does.
Yep.
Which also has its place in sports, I feel.
It really does. I think I don't know how I didn't think about that, but you're right, because it's not on field entertainment, but he is absolutely, every time he goes in front of the media and says something pointed against another manager, he's trying to create the next drama for the next like episode.
That's right.
Of the dating drama. Like he is the cliffhanger. His press conferences are the cliffhanger mm-hmm. for every next episode.
He's like the producers on The Bachelor who intentionally try to sabotage people's relationships to stir up drama. Which is why I stopped watching The Bachelor, because it made me angry.
The plot twist is Jose has actually been sabotaging his own career just so he gets more social media fans.
That's so funny. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I love this conversation. I love most of these people that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And I think that's all I have on this, John. Do you have anything else you want to say on this subject?
No, I think I just, obviously sports is always like, sort of a battle between warring ecosystems of, you know, the desire that we have to win games and that desire we have for sports to be reality TV, you know? And I think that tension between those two kind of dynamics that's at the heart of what sports is, like competition and entertainment.
Yeah.
Is, I don't know, it's just like, it's a really unique place that's make sports different and better than any reality TV show that you could possibly watch, because the competition always like keeps it in focus, but the reality TV show elements just always kind of come out in random moments and you're like, what on earth is going on?
You just wake up to watch a Sunday or a Saturday Premier League game, and then Thomas Tuchel and Antonio Conte have this big like brouhaha. These two managers like, just get
just
into
like grabbing
it.
Each other's hands. I'm like, what are you doing?
Yeah,
like,
any given Saturday, you just get this big, big drama. Yeah, John, I think the podcast that I would direct people to if they want to go even deeper for another one of our podcasts is the podcast where we talked about sports documentaries and like sports mm-hmm. shows, because those kind of things, like, I don't know how far you are in an all or nothing arsenal, but those kind of things, I think, where you see, like, we watched the one with Jose Mourinho when he was at Tottenham mm-hmm. or Hard Knocks in the NFL. Those are literally when sports become reality TV shows. Literally, they are just mm-hmm. documentary shows. And so I think those are kind of the moments where you get the biggest crossover. And we did a podcast where we listed some of our favorite ones of those as well. So that's where I would recommend if you want to go another hour deeper than this hour already into that mm-hmm. topic. So
yeah, I'll put the link on Twitter. Y'all can definitely listen to that one. Yeah, I really enjoyed that one, and you know, I learned a lot about sports documentaries. But yeah, it's sports is a great drama at all times, and that's part of why we love it.
You guys know what to do. Subscribe, rate, review, interact with us on social media, all the things. Until next week, be well and be safe, and we'll talk to you later.
Cheers, guys.